James is the Executive General Manager of the Menzies Research Centre. He has been involved in government and politics for 25 years, joining the Australian Liberal Party at age 17. He went on to serve the Howard government for 6 years, including in the Prime Minister's office. We will be talking with him about the emergence of grassroots politics and how it plays such a key role in national issues. Tim James, welcome to Cross Pacific Conversation.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me along.
Well, Tim, you mentioned over coffee that you have some American connections that are pretty deep. What are they?
Well, thanks for asking, Ed. And I do, and I'm very much proud of my family, my heritage. You know, the history of it's on my mother's side. So I am the grandson of a U.S. serviceman who came to Australia for the Second World War and met my grandmother, an Australian nurse, and they fell in love. My mum was the eldest of five daughters, born in Brisbane just before the end of the war, and then was raised in America. And so I've got a big American family, lots of aunts and uncles and cousins. And I'm really proud of my U.S. connections.
Well, we want to talk a bit about those U.S. connections, because these are grassroots people in the United States that you know. And you've done a lot of grassroots work here, including with me and our local community on issues. But grassroots really exploded in the United States on January the 6th. People from all over the United States, firemen, policemen, the kind of what we call, what Howard called them, the little people, or the guys who...
I think Howard called them the battlers.
The battlers. The battlers came to battle and take over the country. So we want to talk a bit about how that level of politics shapes national politics on both sides of the Pacific. Tim, how does your institute and the kind of work you do reflect local politics at the national level?
Yeah, so the Menzies Research Centre is the Liberal Party's affiliated think tank, and we've been around for 25 years. And our role is to research and develop and advocate good public policy that will serve our party, but obviously most of all serve our country. Now, as to grassroots, I mean, I think this is part of the challenge that we all face today in this busy, you know, modern 24-hour news cycle-driven world, is how do you keep in touch with the ordinary man or woman on the street, the grassroots, those who are, as they say, at the coalface. And that's a big challenge. And we're a small think tank of four people. So, in the end, we are informed, of course, from a range of different sources, you know, party leadership, government leadership, our principles, of course, Menzian principles driving our stance and outlook. But importantly, we're also an organisation driven by people, in as much as we rely on people to be our subscribers, our donors, to come to our events, to purchase books. And so we think we've got a pretty good read on what it is that our constituency, if I can put it that way, is seeking from us and hoping for us to achieve.
But how do you get that? Because if you think of the Brookings Institution in the United States or the various other think tanks, national leadership think tanks, the Federalists, and so on. I read their pamphlets, but they never mention the man on the street. They may have gotten their information there, but it doesn't come through. How do you really tap into that local need and interest?
Yeah, look, I think it's difficult. As I say, it's a challenge. In the end, it just comes down to listening. And obviously, you know, being...
What are those tools for listening? Do you run surveys? How do you get it?
Yeah, we do. Early last year, we ran a membership survey, and we're about to do another one soon enough. And that goes to questions of what issues people would like to see us pursue. That won't decide, you know, our agenda, but we want to genuinely consult. And what kind of means of communication? I mean, we all, I think, live in the world in which we are sort of almost over-informed. But, you know, we have a weekly newsletter, obviously social media, though our Facebook page has just been taken down, but that's another discussion.
That's another show.
Yeah. You're not alone there, Tim.
No,
you're not alone.
quite right.
We've been taken down too, but yeah. Keep going.
So look, it comes back to listening and obviously talking. And, you know, I mean, we seek to run, last year was rather more difficult for obvious reasons, but we seek to run events in each capital city each year around the country. You know, our office is in Sydney. We have an office office in Canberra and a small office in Melbourne, but you know, our friends in Perth, in Tassie and elsewhere, we want to be amongst them and we want to be listening to them and having a drink and a chat with them. And so we seek to every year make the time to do just that.
Do you, in terms of when you started in politics, do you feel now? You started in '93. You joined the Liberal Party,
yes.
And that was from memory, John Hewson.
The year of the so-called unlosable election.
Yes, yes, John Hewson and Fight Back.
Yes.
And so then you also saw the tradition, the transition from John Hewson as opposition leader to a different John, the former Treasurer John Howard, who then became Prime Minister in '96.
Yeah.
How did you see a shift away from traditional, I guess, conservative politics into, I guess, what John Howard pioneered in terms of talking to the grassroots and talking to the battlers, as he called them?
Yeah, great question. And actually, I've been thinking about this in recent times because very shortly, on the 2nd of March this year, we will mark 25 years since the election of the Howard government. It was the 2nd of March 1996, and you're right, there was quite a significant shift in a number of ways, I think, in terms of how the coalition campaigned, the John Howard persona, obviously, you know, policies put forward. And I well remember that campaign. I always recall the campaign slogan was "For all of us," and you might recall there was a song, there was an ad. I mean, you know, political campaign advertising was maybe a little bit different back then, but the campaign song went like this, you know, for all of us, not just for one, not just for some, for all of us. Mm-hmm. And in a sense, that was what obviously the coalition was seeking to convey, was that they wanted to bring the country together, take the country forward. As John Howard said, he wanted a comfortable, confident, more relaxed Australia that knew its place in the world and was at ease with that. And I think Howard, I mean, having worked for him, I think I can comment, you know, he really actually did love to get out and talk to people, and he was very comfortable and very happy and would relish the opportunity to get out onto the streets of Eastwood or Epping or other parts of Bennelong, you know, where I had the pleasure of working for him, to talk to people. And I think, you know, those conversations are precious. Now, you know, to what extent these days they're quality conversations because you've got a, you know, media pack and everyone's sort of under the spotlight.
But in COVID, Biden, that was his strategy. Remember, he went out and drive-ins and so on and had conversations with the people, not slogans, not rants, but conversations. And still doing that.
And Bill Clinton really pioneered that in the
90s. Yeah, he did that.
That sort of grassroots politics.
That kind of grassroots.
Or grassroots campaigning,
I should
say.
Do you think this kind of grassroots campaigning, not cultism, can come back? Or will there be all those special interests that kind of dominate the scene?
Yeah, I think it is still there. It's just that we now have a more fast, data-driven, sophisticated means of campaigning. I mean, the way in which a party or candidate can use tools and technology in order to target, you know, segments or people or families or certain parts of their communities is really quite extraordinary these days. But I still say this to anyone in politics: there is no substitute for walking the streets and knocking on people's front doors.
All right. I agree with that. You started at 17. Now, when we walk the streets around Mosman High School, we don't find many kids interested in joining the Liberal Party or the Labor Party or any of that. But you and I both, I started at 21, you at 17. I was president of the Local Parent Teachers Association. Didn't have any kids at the school. But that was my way, my uncle said. If you're ever going to Congress, you start here. Is that still true?
Oh, I think that's right. I mean, you've got to, from a young age, feel a sense of service, of dedication to, you know, causes, obviously, you know, beyond yourself. In a lot of ways, you know, it's making, I mean, public life is a career that goes well beyond the bounds of a normal career. And in the end, you've got to be driven by a sense of the concerns of others. You need to not obviously sort of see everything through the prism of your own life and your own experience. Of course, we all do to some degree. But in the end, it is service. It is public service. And that is your job, is to facilitate those concerns and those issues and priorities of those people, and to listen to them, to consult with them, to address their problems, and to put forward options to make their lives better.
Let me put forward a notion that I've heard some kids talking about. Those old guys don't know what they're talking about, and it doesn't do any good to involve ourselves with them because they're really off the planet. They're talking with their thumbs now. We're not engaged in that conversation. When I was 21 and you were 17, we talked to people who were 50. There's a little group inside, groupthink among young people that's disengaging with national politics, I think. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, and it isn't necessarily just young people either, Ed. I think and there's a range of reasons for this, whether it's the rise of social media or a more kind of disintermediated media landscape, you can see the sort of growing tribalism. We all kind of hear the arguments about, well, how much is a particular platform a genuine vehicle for debate and discussion and different points of view, or how much of it, in fact, might be some kind of echo chamber.
Mm.
And it's a different world today. I mean, back in Mosman in February of 1945, when Robert Menzies was setting up the Liberal Party, he came and addressed — this was one of the very earliest meetings of the Liberal Party anywhere around Australia — and he addressed a gathering at Mosman Town Hall, and it was, advertised, and people were encouraged to come along and listen to Bob Menzies. And there were, I'm told, history records, about 2,000 people.
Wow.
Who came along. And that was kind of the norm back then, these big town hall meetings, people...
Kind of Abraham Lincoln, Douglas.
Yeah. And now you tend not to see so much of that these days. Politics is... without wanting to be cynical about it, it tends to be a little more scripted, controlled, tightly held.
Yeah.
It's not what it used to be. But I do sometimes wonder, and this is going to sound a bit old-fashioned, but if you or me or any one of us, Ed, were to book the Mosman Town Hall today and say to our community, we're going to come along and talk about our vision for our community and our country, I wonder how many people would actually come.
Well, probably you, me, and one other person.
Our families.
Our families.
What about me?
Oh,
I fall into the young millennial that wouldn't show up, hey?
No, I don't know if you would or would not, but you might be there for the radio station.
That's true. I wouldn't miss out on that opportunity, no. Yep.
But let's go back to that. How do you reawaken the roots and not change them into a cult?
Yeah. How do you cut through, to talk and listen and really understand ordinary people? Well, I think you do it through civil society, through family, through community, clubs, societies, obviously sport in our country is a, big way that we bring people together.
Don't kneel.
Yeah. So, there's politics everywhere, right?
Or on Facebook, don't say the wrong thing.
Yes.
If you're an athlete.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think, if you have a quality interaction with people, and that's much more likely to happen, right, at, let's say, your local club of Mosman rowers, for example, mm-hmm. Ed, because I know that's a place dear to both of us, you're much more likely to, have a valuable, thoughtful, meaningful conversation, over a drink at your local club than you are like tic-tacking on Twitter or Facebook or some other platform or even on your mobile. It's about the sort of quality and depth and substance of those engagements. And look, we're all busy people these days, but I think you've really got to make the time and you've got to be willing to do it and you've got to want to do it.
Well, now you're in a particular position where that's part of your responsibility. But I dare say I haven't seen my local member dropping in at the club, only scripted meetings. How is that going to inspire a kid at the local high school to become a local member? Because that's where it starts, isn't it? In the United States and here. How do we get that civic energy away from personal stylistic things that you are fill in the blank. You can do code better than anybody else. And these are things that take young people's energy. But if we're going to start the democracy, get it back to what we saw, Menzies, et cetera, how do we do that?
Well, look, I think, I mean, you've got to have some courage. You've got to be willing to put yourself out there. You got to sort of get out of your comfort zone. I think you've got to be not so, you know, controlled and scripted and tightly stage managed. And you've got to be willing to have the hard conversation.
When you say you, I know you do this, but how do you get a kid locally to come along with you doing this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ed.
Because that's a question. This platform's in the United States and here. You're talking from this side, and some of your listeners are going to be in Iowa.
Well, you know what? I think you've got to bring it back to first principles, right? I mean, in the end, we're all human. We're all real. We all mm-hmm. want to feel a sense of inspiration, of direction, of, you know, of reason, you know, to get out, to care, you know, to have regard to our democracy. I mean, one of the concerns I have about, you know, our country, and I think this is true in the States as well, is just the sort of level of apathy or people kind of put it in the too hard basket. But in the end, our democracy is only as good as we, the people, are going to be prepared to make it.
But
it's up to us.
Don't you think as well that apathy has come from the fact that, I mean, I know for some people, it's just one big headache. It's a lot of people shouting at each other from one end of the corridor to the next.
Yeah.
And that's not really enticing for a lot of people. Maybe for, you know, those of us who are on the debating team or society at sure. school, and you know, always sort of had that in them. But there's a lot of people that is just a big turn off to. There's a loss of respect, I think, that's come with public conversation in the public dialogue.
Couldn't agree more. So someone who I think is doing a really nice job of tackling this challenge is our former Deputy Prime Minister John Anderson, who is saying to the world, we are not going to find good policies and good solutions in a bad debate. He's mm-hmm. essentially saying we've got to be able to have civil discussions and civil debates in order to, you know, take ourselves forward. And so he's trying to encourage people to, you know, listen to podcasts, which is clearly a very good thing to do, but to, you know, to come along to events, to be thoughtful, to be well read, to engage in, you know, events, and I guess really to sort of put the participation back into our participative democracy. If our democracy is kind of, you know, quiet and people tend to, you know, want to stay at home and just, you know,
or just get excited,
punch in 140 characters,
yeah,
then we're not going to have the sort of quality of engagement that I think we need.
Yeah, one of the things I'm concerned about is between elections, people are not being excited. Now, African Americans got very excited in the last election. But that won't last unless there's something almost every week, every day, to ensure that people feel that the democracy's there. How would you go about that? Because I think that's the street you're going down now.
Well, I think, again, I would come back to that great quote from Tip O'Neill many, many years ago, which John Howard and others themselves employed, and that is that all politics is local. So we all live somewhere, right? We're all part of a community. You know, lots of people have kids in local schools, or they rely on local facilities, hospitals, libraries, you know, you name it. And we all, much as we might kind of, you know, admit it or do something about it, we all actually want those communities to be as strong as can be.
Mm.
And for us to be included, you know, for us to be heard, for us to seek to fulfill our potential. I think that is our kind of natural human instinct, is to seek to advance our condition. And so getting people involved at the local level, again, all politics is local. It's one of the best places you can start. And so it's, you know, it's, again, it's clubs, mm-hmm. societies, local groups.
Yeah, one of the things, I've been here over 20 years, and Tim and I are involved in the same club. And every Friday, we have Reshape the World at that club, but there are new people who come into the group and out of the group, and they have children and grandchildren and the like. My fear is we're not getting younger. And that kind of conversation, that kind of discourse has to start with people in their 20s and 30s now. and they're not coming to our clubs.
I would point out that they might not be coming to your clubs, but they might be going to or starting their own.
That's great.
You know, I think I actually do see a lot of young people that are very much engaged within politics, but it might not be within the traditional parties.
Yeah, sure.
So how do we tap that?
Well, I think it comes back to issues. And I think, you know, you referenced as well, you know, the John Howard For All of Us campaign slogan. But I think that's actually, and I think it's really relevant to the United States as it is here in Australia. Mm. I think that really does actually genuinely need to mean For All of Us. Mm. So not just those of us that look like the other, but you know, we're a very multicultural society, this country, so is the United States. And I think especially I'm seeing with the younger generation, they want a society that really represents that, and they want a government that really represents that, and leadership that does.
Yeah, agree. And I think they also want to be part of a country and a society that that has confidence, that isn't always, you know, questioning itself or sort mm-hmm. of seeking to challenge its own history. Of course, you know, we must learn the lessons of history, but you know, people want to feel part of a group, a society, a country that is confident, that can be decisive, that knows who it is, that mm-hmm. has a strong culture and one that is obviously engaging and unifying. And you know, I think sometimes it's easy in this world to focus on the, you know, those things that divide us. You know, Howard always said that when we focus on what unites us rather than what divides us, we are always stronger together. And that is absolutely
so. I think Biden said something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure he probably did, and probably Obama likewise. And it's such a kind of simple thing to say, right? But it's easy in this day and age to get kind of focused on the negatives, the points of division or tension or difference, and actually to not put into enough perspective that we do have a lot of good and a lot of goodwill and people coming together and a lot of service and a lot of dedication to people and country and community.
Well, let's build on this. The idea and the grassroots start at 6 to, you know, 96. Every one of those levels has a place to be. And if we can get these discourses about what would make a great society, not as tribes, but as groups, mm-hmm. we can go someplace. And we need to start that in the schools so that young people, right now in both countries, you start a conversation about anything that sounds semi-political and they shut it right down.
Correct. Suffocating.
You can't even wear some colors to school. Wear a red T-shirt and teachers might ask you to go home.
Yep.
Or a blue one. That's sending the wrong message, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Look, absolutely. I mean, our whole civilization, our world today here in the Western world was essentially founded upon fundamental freedoms, you know, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of association, freedom of belief. But all of these freedoms are under some challenge at the present time from a range of different quarters. And yet they are the essential building blocks for having the sort of civil discourse, the discussion, the willingness to listen, to respect, to understand mm-hmm. one another, to have people showing empathy for one another. If we're not free to talk and think mm-hmm. and debate as we might think, then we are reining in that space, that capacity that really needs to be there for us to solve the problems of today.
How do you feel that we're under threat, or those freedoms are under threat, as you say?
Oh, well, I mean, whether it's in terms of, you know, process, so obviously a hot one at the moment is the extent to which, you know, there is a level of censorship on platforms, you know, social media or indeed mainstream media or otherwise. And, I mean, free speech is not boundless, but we've got to be extremely careful yeah. not to be deplatforming or censoring or cancelling people or institutions mm. just because people don't share their politics or their point of view.
But does it also not go back to what we were talking about, and that's about having a respectful dialogue and conversation with each other? Now, there are, in terms of censorship, I wouldn't exactly call it censorship that's happening, but I think there is more of a focus now on actually being respectful and not putting out opinions and viewpoints that are actually quite offensive to one part of society, or as I referenced, the many cultures that make us up. I think freedom of speech should always be encouraged, but I don't think it should encompass any sort of racism or sexism. And I think it's quite right for that to be called out, because I don't think that really is constructive towards a inclusive society.
Well, that just drives people apart rather than bringing them together.
And misinformation. I mean, if we're talking about looking at what's happening at the moment with Donald Trump, and then we've got Craig Kelly and George Christensen here with
anti-vax,
with health, all that sort of the Pete Evans. That does present a danger in a sense. Would you not agree?
Yeah, I think there are inherent dangers in people being overly inflammatory or, you know, getting carried away. But I do say this, and I said this recently on national television, I think the law has got free speech pretty much right. So the current law essentially says this: you are free to speak your mind up to the point where you are starting to threaten or intimidate or harass someone. So my view is, unless you are doing those things, I think you should be pretty free to speak.
Sure. You can say, I don't care for vaccinations, but not that you shouldn't get one.
Sure.
So I think that is free speech. But we're coming kind of to the end of this. What are lessons for the United States and Australia? We're both on the edge now in terms of community information and the like. One of the things we had in the State Department that I would love to see again is young people from various countries visiting when it's called the Young Leaders Program. These were young people first and second year of uni, came to the United States and went to Iowa and Pittsburgh. And sure, they had a trip, stopped over in New York. But the United States is not New York City. It's Pittsburgh. It's Wichita.
Yeah.
And here it's Dubbo.
Yeah, I think actually—
It's not Canberra.
I think people—
Dubbo's one example.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no, there's nothing better really than being able to, as I've had the pleasure of doing, you know, getting out to parts of America that are not Hollywood and not the Big Apple, but where, you know, you can understand ordinary communities, and they're not ordinary. Most of the time they are extraordinary. But to be able to kind of see the real world, as it were, and vice versa, I think, for Americans to come to Australia too. And when that happens, when people do that, and they do perhaps more than we realise today, but I still think there's plenty of room to do it some more, I think they do actually realise that our countries have a lot in common. We are good, strong, open democracies. Yes, there are challenges and pressures upon us, but you know, if we focus on what unites us and we don't take for granted what we have, you know, we are in very good shape. I still think these two nations, more than anywhere else in the world, are the countries where more people from across this earth would love to come and set up their lives and raise a family and set up a business. And that's got to be a pretty surefire test.
There's certainly a lot of truth in that. Absolutely. Tim James, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It was great to chat.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
If you enjoyed what you heard from this episode of Pacific Conversations, make sure to subscribe wherever you find the podcast, and even drop it a review if you're feeling generous. Check out the website as well, edtalks.com.au, for information on upcoming chats and for Ed's other podcast, US of Ed, with myself, Sean Britton, regarding weekly US news and current affairs.